one of the very unique aspects of Pesach is the extreme stringency that is attached to the prohibition of eating chametz. Just to think of several of the examples. First of all, in the Torah itself already, we have that not only can't you eat chametz on Pesach, you need to stay away from chametz. That's the famous pasuk in Parshas Bo, where the Torah says, "Ach, bayom harishon, however on the first day, tashbisu se'or mibateichem, get rid of all the se'or, all the leaven and all that is leaven, all that is chametz, from your homes." The Gemara says, what does it mean, but on the first day? It means the first day is the day before Pesach, but on the first day means from midday. From already 12 o'clock, there's a mitzvah not to have any chametz. Now, whether that means you should destroy chametz or you should be in a state of not having chametz, but there is a mitzvah already from Erev Pesach not to have chametz, which is clearly just a mitzvah to keep us away from the real mitzvah, keep us away from the real, dire violation, which is the violation of eating chametz. In fact, there are some who say that the prohibition of owning chametz is also offense. To keep us away from eating chametz, the Torah also prohibits even owning chametz, even seeing chametz that I own over Pesach. And that's just midoraisa. Then you get into rabbinic law. So the sages said, okay, chametz is prohibited on Erev Pesach, on the eve of Pesach, from midday. Stay away from chametz entirely. An hour before, you should already not have any enjoyment from the chametz. And an hour before that, maybe you get confused with a cloudy day, don't even eat any chametz. And to add to the stringencies of the sages, we have a principle in halacha which states that an item in a mixture is only considered to be there from the perspective of halacha if you can taste it. So say I mix in, by mistake, I have a pot, and the pot has some milk on the bottom. I didn't realize, and I poured into the pot a large amount of chicken soup, and now I've boiled it all in the oven, and I can't tell what's the milk, what's the chicken soup, it's all mixed in. So it depends. If the milk is still tasted, if when you taste from the pot, you could still taste some milk. So the milk doesn't lose its identity. That's called ta'am ki ikar. The taste that's there is like the real thing is there. If you can't taste the milk, at that point it's already permitted. So if you have a thousand, usually the Gemara says it takes 60 times more permissible amount than the prohibited to render the taste null and void. So if you had 60 times more chicken soup than the milk, usually the milk will then be, the taste of the milk will be gone. But what happens if you would have 1,000 times more chicken soup than the milk? Of course it would be kosher. What about on Pesach? On Pesach, no. If I have even the slightest trace of chametz in a pot, even if I have a pot of 1,000 times more kosher food, also, it's can't eat it. And even the rules of no tein ta'am lefgam, we have a rule that if you have a taste that's 24 hours old, so that taste, if it were to come out of the walls of the pot, is presumed not to taste so good. Doesn't make the food prohibited. And chametz, even after 24 hours, even after 48 hours, even after several months. I haven't used the pot in months. Months ago I used it for noodles. I can't use it on Pesach. And if I use it on Pesach, I need to throw out the food. We don't even know since Tam Lefgam is mutter on Pesach. Chametz aser b'mashu. Chametz is prohibited even with a tiny drop. And to keep people further away from the violation of chametz, the sages said, not only must a person get rid of the chametz in his mind, declaring it ownerless and saying that it's worthless, a person actually has to clean his whole house and make sure to do it the night before. The night before Erev Pesach, we have an obligation of cleaning the whole house to make sure there's no chametz. So why are there so many stringencies attached to the prohibition of chametz? Something which we don't find really almost by any other mitzvah in the Torah. That there are stringencies upon stringencies, layers and layers of distancing that is involved in chametz. The Radbaz raises this question. And the Radbaz said, he looked and he looked and he looked at all the different answers.
He looked at,
I think so. I think he was the chief rabbi of Cairo. He said that he looked in Rashi, and Rashi says, well, you need to check for chametz. I think this is what Rashi says. Because maybe you'll find a nice piece of chametz, even though you said it was ownerless. Maybe you'll forget about it, and you'll take a bite of it on Pesach. Or the other Rishonim say, maybe you didn't have full intention when you said it was ownerless, because it's a lot of chametz and worth a lot of value. And so therefore you need to get rid of it also, besides saying that it's ownerless. He said that doesn't answer all of the stringencies. He said the only answer he could find was the answer that's found in the Kabbalistic literature, and we find an echo of this in the Gemara, in the Seches Brachas. The Gemara tells us, Rabbi Alexandri, Basar Tzluse Amar Hachi. Rabbi Alexandri, after he finished davening, he would make the following personal petition. Yiratzom ulfanecha Hashem Elokeinu, may it be your will, God, shetamidenu bekeren ora, that you should have us stand in the corner of light, al tamidenu bekeren chashecha, we shouldn't stand in the corner of darkness. In other words, we should merit to study Torah and to understand it. Val yidveli beinu, we shouldn't feel bad. Val yachshechu einenu, and our eyes shouldn't be darkened. Ika the Amri, others said, Amri Rebbe Alexandri, what Rebbe Alexandri used to say was, Ribon HaOlamim, Master of the World, Galui V'yadua L'fanecha Sh'ritzoneinu La'asos V'tzoncha. It is clear and apparent before you that our will is to do your will. U'mi ma'akev, who is holding us back? Sa'or Sheba Isa, the leaven that's in the bread, the Shiabud Malchias, and the rule of kingdoms. Yiratzom ulfanecha, may it be your will, God, shetatzilenu meyadam. You should save us from their hands. Nashuv lasos chukei ritzonecha b'level shalom. And we should come back to fulfilling your will with a full heart. Namely, he would say, we really want to serve you, but who is stopping us from serving you? Sa'or shebe'isa, the leaven that's in bread. In those days, when they would make bread, they would first take a piece of dough that had really spoiled significantly. That would be the yeast, and they'd put that into the dough, and that would speed up the fermentation process with the regular dough, and then it would all rise. So what's stopping us from serving God? The rule of kingdoms. Okay, that's understandable, whether it's totalitarian regimes or atheistic regimes. They prevent us from serving God, anti-Semitic regimes. But how does the leaven that's in the bread prevent us from serving God? And what does Rashi say? What does Sa'or Shebe'isa? Rashi says it's Yetzer Hara Shadul Vavein. It's the evil urge that's in our hearts. So we see, said the Ridbaz, that the Chametz, the Sa'or Shebe'isa, is really a symbol of the evil urge. It's a symbol of the Yetzer Hara. And that's why there's so many stringencies around chametz, to get rid of every scrap of the evil urge. This is the evil urge itself. This represents the evil urge. This is what stops us from serving God, that we have this urge within us to do evil. We need to get rid of every scrap of this evil urge. That's why there's so many stringencies about chametz, because when we're getting rid of chametz, when a Jew and a Jewish mother are cleaning their home to clean the home from chametz, it's like a person cleaning out the Yetzer Hara. So here we have the evil urge on the run. We want to really make sure to get him out and run after him and pursue him. So we look in every nook and cranny, get rid of every single crumb, no taste whatsoever of the Yetzer Hara. So how is chametz, how is that which, the leaven of bread, how is that a symbol of the evil urge? Why is the evil urge considered the leaven in the bread? We know that the Gemara sometimes calls the evil urge unfeeling. Now, we can understand it's unfeeling. It's not inspired. It's not connected to Hashem. Doesn't feel the closeness to God. But why is rising bread a symbol of the evil urge? think on the first level, rising bread is a symbol of the evil urge, because the foundation of the evil urge is arrogance, is a selfishness, is an enlarged sense of self. I'm very important, I'm very powerful, I'm very necessary. That's what happens when you take water and you mix the water with the flour and you let it sit. With time, it gets big. It's like a person who's very filled with himself, who's very high with himself. It's a symbol of great arrogance. And you know, we have to get rid of chametz fully. Fully get rid of chametz. The Gemara tells us, if you look at the Gemaros, there are really four different ways to get rid of chametz. Rabbi Yehuda says you're supposed to burn chametz. The Gemara says, the sages say, the Mishnah tells us, there are other ways. You could be mafazer v'zorah l'ruach. You could crumble it and throw it into the wind. You could throw it to a river. Or you can say that it's bata. You can say it's meaningless. Ke'afa da'ara, like the earth of the ground. The ancient... You could sell it. Right, that's not mentioned in the Mishnah. That's not mentioned. Right, I mean, the selling, the Gemara says that the chametz of a non-Jew, you're allowed to see, it's not a violation of Bayura Valumatzeh. During the Middle Ages, many Jews really had no means of livelihood. The non-Jews wouldn't let us engage in the professions that they were engaged in. Especially in Eastern Europe, all they would allow is they would allow the Jews to have inns. And the Jews were the bartenders. They could sell alcohol because the Christians wouldn't sell alcohol. So the Jews would be the ones who would be given permission to sell alcohol. So it happened that there were many poor Jews who all of their wealth was tied up to the barrels of whiskey that they had in their inn that they were selling to the local Ukrainian or Lithuanian or Polish peasants or Russian peasants. So Pesach became a very great challenge for these Jews to take basically all of their livelihood and dump it out, to pour out all the whiskey, get rid of it. And many of them were on leased land that was leased from a Polish landowner or a Russian landowner, a Paritz. They wouldn't pay their rent. They would be thrown into jail. They could be enslaved. So it became very, very difficult for them to really get rid of all the chametz, because the whiskey is chametz, and that was their entire livelihood. So to help them out, someone realized that, you know, the truth is you're allowed to have chametz of a non-Jew. So what we'll do is we'll sell the chametz to the non-Jews. So that's what we do. We sell the chametz to non-Jews. And it's a very serious sale. We have six different methods of sale that we do with the non-Jew. First of all, we have the non-Jew pay for it. He pays a percentage. He doesn't have to pay for everything right away, but he gives a down payment to everyone who fills out a form that they want to sell chametz. They have to also fill out an estimated value of what that is. Maybe they appoint someone as their representative to sell the chametz for them by filling out this form. And that representative calculates. I have 45 forms. Each form is roughly about $100 worth of chametz that's being sold. About $4,500 worth of chametz that I'm selling. So whoever's doing the sale sits down with a non-Jew. In Riverdale, they sell it to a fellow by the name of John J. Brown. And Mr. Brown says, okay, if there's $4,500 worth of chametz, I'm certainly interested in buying it, but I don't want to pay all $4,500 right away. I'll give a down payment. I'll pay 10 cents on every $100. So instead of giving $4,500, he'll give 45 times 10 cents. He'll give $4.50. He'll give $4.50 for all the chametz. And that's the first type of sale. And besides the sale of doing the acquisition through money, he also does a kinyan sudur. He is given a handkerchief and he lifts it up and then he gives it back. So that symbolic act of taking ownership of the handkerchief by lifting it up causes the chametz to be transferred to him in a barter when he gives it back. Besides the Kinyan Chalipin, he also has a Kinyan Shtar. He signs a document where he and the representative of the one selling all the chametz both sign the same document that he is purchasing all the chametz. In addition to a Kinyan Shtar, he also acquires the chametz by means of a Kinyan Chatzer. He rents wherever the chametz is found. So if the chametz is in a closet, if the chametz is in a room, the chametz is in the whole house. He'll rent the house, or he'll rent the closet, or rent the room. Then, since he owns the closet and rooms, it's his courtyard, and what's in his courtyard belongs to him by means of the acquisition of a courtyard. So he acquires the chametz by means of a kinyan chatzer. And then, besides a kinyan chatzer, we also sell him some land. We have a halacha that even though chametz is movable, if you do an act of acquisition on land, through acquiring the land, you can then acquire movables with it. So he pays for land, and by buying the land, he's also buying all the chametz. And finally, we have a sixth type of kinyan, which is called situmta, namely a normative business practice. We do that too. We shake hands with the non-Jew. So we have six acquisitions just to be 100% sure that this sale works, that it's a real sale, and he buys the chametz. And in theory, he could come and use that chametz, but then he'd have to pay the rest of the cost of the chametz, and then after Pesach, we buy it back from him.
I'll tell the story that he's doing it with each one for a long time, and one time he forgot one of them, and he mentioned it.
Maybe Mr. Brown remembered all the types of how to... He is, he's a lawyer, and he's a wealthy man in his own right. Real estate entrepreneur, and he certainly takes it very seriously, the buying of the chametz, and he wants to know what type of chametz it is and how much it's worth. And about half of New York sells to Mr. Brown. Or half the rabbis of New York are there, and everyone's selling to him. I think he is. I think he's a wasp or something. He's been, I think his ancestors were on the Mayflower, but he's a real, real non-Jew.
Why did the form where the keys to the house are? Did they're supposed to have access to the house? Technically?
The form should either say where the keys are or who has the keys and how you reach that person.
I haven't really seen a form for
that. The form should. Should have a way of how you can get in touch with how you can get into the house. Many times the person is staying at the house, so the owner, you get to the house by knocking on the door and you can come right in. But it's a very real sale, the sale of chametz. But that's not mentioned in the Mishnah. The Mishnah only mentions four ways of getting rid of chametz: bittul, throwing to the river, throwing to the wind, and burning. Rav Moshe Wolfson pointed out that the truth is that ancient science taught us that there were four basic elements to the world. The element of energy, what they called fire. The element of gases, they called it wind. The element of liquids, they called it water. The element of water. And finally, the element of solids, they called it dust. So the Mishnah just happens to mention four ways of destroying chametz: throwing it to a river, that's the element of water; throwing it to the wind, that's the element of wind, of gases; saying that it's worthless like dust, that's the element of dust; and burning it, that's the element of fire, of energy, because we're supposed to totally destroy chametz. In every dimension of the world, we have to wipe out this chametz, we have to get rid of it. If we think about this analogy, what's the most powerful way to get rid of chametz from the eyes of halacha? The best way is by saying that it's ownerless. Bittul. If you say it's ownerless, it's worthless, that can affect chametz that you don't even see. Whereas if you want to throw it to the wind, you actually have to have it and throw it out into the wind. Or throw it to the river, you need to put it into a river. Or into a fire, you need to throw it into the fire. But saying that it's worthless and ownerless, even the chametz that you don't see becomes worthless and ownerless in that manner. Because the truth is, the foundation of chametz is arrogance. The foundation of chametz is feeling filled with oneself, about how proud one is, how great one is. When I say that it's worthless, it's nothing, it's the dust, it has no value, that's the most powerful way. And that also teaches us, in terms of the evil urge, how to counteract the evil urge. The most powerful way of counteracting the evil urge is to realize that it's empty, that it's meaningless, that it's nothingness. As Nachman of Breslov used to say, that in his mind the evil urge is like a trickster who's at a village fair, and he runs around with his hands closed, and he says to people, if you can guess what's in my hand, I'll give it to you. And people immediately start to imagine that there are all sorts of great treasures in this person's hand, maybe a diamond, maybe a gold ring. And he says, okay, guesses, all who want to guess, step forward, you have to give me 5 kopecks per guess. And people start imagining, well, you know, we'll pay a little bit, but if we get the right thing, we'll be earning millions of dollars, or who knows what. They all give in their coins, and then he finally opens his hand, and it's empty. That's the evil urge. It runs around with a closed hand, trying, what's that? Wall Street, yeah. It's coming around, it's trying to sell us something, tells us it's of great value, it's who knows what it, you know, you'll get tremendous pleasure by doing this or by doing that. And the moment a person gets into it, the person realizes it's empty, it's just, it's like trying to hold on to a sunbeam. There's nothing there, there's no there there. Rav Wolfson said maybe that's really the deeper idea of a famous Medrash and a Gemara. The Gemara relates about Nachum Ish Gamzu, that Nachum Ish Gamzu always said, Gamzu Latova. This is also for the best. Whatever happened, he would say, Gamzu Latova. The Gemara has a famous story that Nachum was once had to go to Rome to make an appeal to the Roman Caesar, and he was carrying a chest of treasures, and when he got to the inn, the innkeeper saw all these valuables in the chest. He took out the valuables and he replaced it with dirt. And Nachum didn't realize, and he went into Rome and he offers this bribe to the king, this gift from the Jews. They open it up and it's dirt. So Nachum doesn't panic. He says, Gamzu Latova, it's all for the best. And I don't remember if he said or someone said, well, maybe it's holy dirt. Wasn't there a tradition that the dirt of Avraham Avinu thrown against his enemies. When Avram went to fight to save Lot, the dirt that Avram Avinu threw turned into spears, and that turned into the weapons that defeated the 4 kings. And therefore, maybe it's this powerful dirt. Maybe that's what it is. So they used it, and it turned out that it was this miraculous dirt. And then the Gemara says that this innkeeper thought, oh, you know, if I have magic dirt in my backyard, so he'll bring his dirt too. So he ran over, he said, you know, the dirt really came from my backyard. And here's the magic dirt. And they said, good, we'll use it. And it stayed as dirt. It didn't accomplish anything. And then they put the innkeeper to death. So what is the idea of this medrash that Avram Avinu, when he went out to war, he threw dirt and the dirt turned into spears and swords and arrows? So Wolfson suggested Avram Avinu went to war against 4 kings. He went to war against representatives of Chametz. These were kings, some had the process of getting rid of it through water didn't work, the process of getting rid through fire didn't work. These kings represented Chametz. The best way to get rid of Chametz is to throw dirt, to say it's meaningless, it's nothing, it's of no value, it has no importance, there's nothing to be scared of, it's nothing in my eyes. He threw the dirt and a miracle occurred. A person has this type of a humility, this is meaningless, this is nothing, then miracles can occur. There's a very beautiful story about Lubavitch, that the Friedrich Rebbe was arrested by the NKVD, by the Soviet secret police, and they demanded that he reveal the identities of all the Lubavitcher shluchim throughout the Soviet Union who were illegally teaching Torah and illegally building mikvaos. And of course the Rebbe wasn't going to do that. So the interrogator took out of his pocket a gun. And he said, I have a little tchotchka, a little toy. He was a fellow New Yiddish. It caused a lot of people to talk. And he started twirling the gun around his finger and intimating that he was going to kill the Rebbe if the Rebbe wouldn't talk. So the Rebbe answered, he said, those people who are scared by that gun believe in one world and in many gods. But I believe in one God and in many worlds. It doesn't matter to me. In other words, what was he saying? He was saying, if you believe in one world, maybe there's no world to come, and there are many gods then. There's the God of wealth, there's the God of honor, there's the God of pleasure, there's the God of relaxation, there's the God of leisure, and you're running after all these gods. The person, heaven forbid, will die, will lose out on all of these gods, and then there's nothing more to live for. That would be the end of everything. So a person has to sacrifice something, sacrifice his friends, sacrifice his family, just to keep the gods happy in order to stay in this world. The Rebbe was saying, I believe in two worlds. So what are you going to do? Take me from this world and put me in a better place? All right, go ahead. I'm not worried. And I believe in one God, and that one God will take me to the next world, and he's going to reward me for doing the right thing. So I'm not afraid. In other words, the Rebbe was showing in a very deep way, you're nothing. You think you're a power? You're an ant. You're a mosquito. You've got no power whatsoever. You're nothing. And that overcomes evil. When you say that the chametz, the sa'or sheba isa, it's nothing, it's meaningless, it's an empty ray of light, there's no there, there's no force there, it's nothing. Laugh at it, it's like the dust. That already can overcome all the forms of evil. So maybe that's sort of one foundation of why we have so many stringencies about chametz, because it's to get away from the evil urge. That concept is a classical concept in many, many books of Jewish thought. Here in this book called Na'os Hadesha, we have several articles from Sachetshav or Rebbeim, from the teachers in Sachetshav, where that theme is developed in different ways. But it's all based on this one theme, namely chametz is identical with the evil urge. Getting rid of chametz is getting rid of the Yetzer Hara, and that's why there's so many stringencies. Let's see how the Sachetshav Rebbe develops this. Yesh lehisponim, this is on page Kuf Samach Vav. We really need to think deeply. The Isser Chametz Mishay Shalos Be'erev Yom Tov, about this prohibition of Chametz on the sixth hour on the day before Yom Tov. Mashalom Atzinu B'chol HaMitzvos HaTluyos B'zman. We don't find in all other mitzvos that are dependent on time, She'yatchilu Michatzi Yom Shalofanav, that they should start a half a day before. So, there is an opinion that connects it to the time of Shechting the Karban Pesach. When you shech the Karban Pesach, you shouldn't have chametz. Fine. So then you can understand why you can't have chametz on Erev Pesach. Because Erev Pesach is the time to shech the Karban Pesach. But according to the opinion, it says that it's derived from the word ach. It's nothing to do with Karban Pesach. But on the day before Yom Tov, you shouldn't have chametz. So then why is that so? Venira. This is the second paragraph. Says the Sachetshav Rebbe, I think the reason why. Dinei b'shas, because the Gemara says, Tana deber b'shmol, b'shmol taught, v'schar shlosha rishon, zachu l'shlosha rishon, in the merit of three firsts, namely, the first day of Yom Tov of Pesach, the first day of Yom Tov of Sukkot, and the first day of shaking lulav. The Jews merited to have three firsts, to destroy the descendants of Esav, who was called the first, to build the Beit HaMikdash, and to merit a king, a redeemer, Mashiach, who is the first. Says the Maharsha, Shehu hashbasa sa'or de Pesach, that the first tier is the first of destroying chametz on Erev Pesach. Ubeschush v'sazu, in the merit of destroying chametz, yizku lahachris zaro shel Esav. We will merit to overcome the descendants of Esav. Nira Od Lomar, and I would like to explain. Zinei B'Medrash, the Medrash explains, by Yikru Shmo Esav, that his name is called Esav, the Medrash says, Hushav Shabarasi Bo'olami, it's the nothingness that I created in my world. Ki Esav, because Esav, Hu Tachlis Hashav V'Hasheker, Esav represents this type of falsehood that the leaven in the bread represents, this inflated sense of self. As an example, the Medrash says that Esav is symbolized by the pig. What does the pig do? It's it pushes out, or it puts out its hooves that are split, as if it's a kosher animal, while inside it doesn't. It's not a kosher animal. It doesn't chew its cud. Shim Kora also. This is Esav with all of his evil. Poshe Tlafav. He puts out his feet. Umareshu Tahar, and he acts as if he's Tahar. And this is like the idea of chametz, shehu misnase, that it lifts itself up, hu misgadol and grows. Ad shunira gadol yoso yidei chelki haruach shem miskabetz besocho. It looks so big, but what's making it big? Just the air bubbles. You can slap it down and it'll be small again. V'hu sheker, it's a lie. It's nothing there. Ukinyin avodazar, it's like idol worship. Shehi sheker, which is the greatest lie of the world. It's such a lie. It's of course it's nonsense. Isa b'shas, the Gemara says, when it comes to idol worship, afilu perish ala aser, even its excrement you should stay away from. Mishum d'nichalei b'nefichah, because it likes it to let loose some, to get rid of some of that waste. V'alkein, and therefore, b'schus hasbasa se'or, in the merit of getting rid of this inflated chametz, Yisrael misracha kimi mahus hasheker, that Jews get away from this falsehood. Shelo tia lahem shum negiabo, Jews don't want to have any contact with it. Umarchikim osamir shusam, and they distance it from their domain. Ulu umaso, and opposite that, misdabkim ba'kadosh baruch Hu, Jews connect with God. The shvisas haregel de Pesach, with the holiday of Pesach. Zochim lahachris zaro shel Esav, we merit to destroy this falsehood of Esav, shutachas hasheker, which is a lie. Yinei shamati mikvot kedushas avi adoni mori v'rabi zecher tzadik livracha l'chaye olam haba. I heard from my father, b'shem harav hakadosh reber zecher tzadik livracha l'chaye olam haba mipshischa, in the name of the Rebbe of Pshischa, v'chal arachakos me'averos hein drabanan. Ayin sham. Generally, when we try to stay away from a sin, say the prohibition to be alone with a woman in a room because it might lead to the sin of having relations with a woman. It's a rabbinic prohibition, mostly. Most of the prohibitions are rabbinic. As it says that the sages were told, Asu mishmeres l'mishmarti. The sages have to make a fence to guard God's safekeeping.
What was
Ayin Sham? Ayin Sham. Al Shem, as it says. Avol harchaka misheker he d'oraisa, but to stay away from a lie, that's biblical. Kamo shekasev, because it says midvar sheker tirchak, stay away from any falsehood. Al kein, therefore iser chametz v'hashbasa se'or, the prohibition of chametz, getting rid of that which is leavened. Sheinyanu husiluk v'hashbasa hasheker, which is really a concept of getting rid of falsehood. Yeshlo gamkin harchaka midoraisa. Even biblically, you have to stay away from it. Those are the 6 hours of before Yom Tov. And we can say, maybe this is the reason why chametz is prohibited, even with a tiny fraction. According to some Rishonim, any time you have a taste of something prohibited, it's not biblical, it's just rabbinic to get away from it. But chametz, shehu mahus hasheker, which is a lie, it's a falsehood. Sharachaka atzmi doraisa, to get away from it is already biblical. So to get away from it would mean not to even have a taste of it. That would be the biblical. So the rabbis have to have a fence around the biblical. They need to add a little more. So they need to add another prohibition. They need to say even a mashu, even a little bit is prohibited. Not only the tam, not only the taste, but even a mashu, because chametz is falsehood. And falsehood we need to stay away from as far as we can. Falsehood, that we can't live with. In fact, there's a beautiful comment of the Chova Salvavos who says that someone once wanted to ask a wise man for advice, what he could do to guarantee that his children would be righteous and good. He said, impress upon your children that they can never tell a lie. They can't lie to themselves, they can't lie to others, they can never tell a lie. You stay away from falsehoods. You always have to tell the truth. You'll already be a good person. It'll already lead you to all the other good things. Chametz is falsehood. Since the Torah says, midvar sheker tirchak, that's what the Torah also says. Stay away from chametz 6 hours before. And that's why the rabbis made all these further laws. Because all the staying aways are already biblical. Because in falsehood, usually when it's another prohibition, like the prohibition of eating milk and meat, so the fence, to stay away from it, that's rabbinic. But here, all the fences are somewhat biblical, because already it's a concept of sheker, and falsehood is already biblical to stay away from it. So the rabbis have to add even more. The second reason that the Shem Yishmuel gives for why there's so many prohibitions for chametz is because Pesach is the beginning. That's here on page Kuf Samach Zayim. Va'od Yeishloma b'tam chametz b'mashu, and another reason why chametz is prohibited even with a tiny amount. Dine Yisrael b'mitzrayim hayu ku'uber b'mei behema. The Jews in Egypt were like a child still in its embryonic stages. And when they left Egypt, then they were a new creation, like a child who's born. And behold, chametz is like the Yetzirah. According to what we said, the same way it its core is a lie, it also pulls to a lie. When the Jews were like a child just born, it doesn't have a strong enough intestinal system to digest foods that are hard to digest. So a child, when he's born, all that he can have is milk or nowadays formula. If we were to give him foods that are hard to digest, his entire digestive system would be damaged. And that's the way it was with the Jews. When we left Egypt, we were leaving a period of gestation. Now we were kekatan shenolad. We were like a child who's born. And therefore, nasar lahem chametz shaya mashchis ruchaniyut harafa. Chametz was prohibited because chametz, which is a lie, would have pulled us to lying, would have pulled us to falsehood, and we were too young and we were too sensitive and too weak to withstand that. V'hayamolid b'hem midas hasheker would have caused them to be born within them the attribute of falsehood. Achinit chazei kocham la'amod neged koach mishichat achimut. So we need to wait till their strength till they become stronger and older to withstand the force of chimut. In other words, when you start a process, you have to start it in a perfect way. When you're later on in a process, then already you can have some compromises. But when you start something, it has to be started in only the best, only the most perfect foundation. And so chametz, that's when we left Egypt, we were born. When we were born, we can't eat food that would attract us to falsehood. We can't eat food that would attract us to evil. We have to start with a pure foundation. So chametz we can't have during Pesach. Every year in Pesach, we're reborn again. We're reborn again now. Now we need to make sure that what comes in is only sensitive things. So we eat matzah. Now matzah is not so easy to digest physically, but it's easy to digest spiritually. Matzah is food that strengthens the neshama. Maybe hard on the stomach, but it's food that's, the Zohar calls it the medicine for the soul. It's like eating vitamins for the soul. So vitamins don't always taste so good. They not taste physically good, but it's vitamins for the soul. And that strengthens us. And then after Pesach, we're already 8 days old, okay? 8 days old, now already we can go back into eat chametz. Now already we can engage in chametz, and hopefully we've been strengthened enough through the matzah of Pesach and through the fulfillments of the mitzvos of Pesach that now the chametz won't have a negative influence on us. Then we have to eat it. Yeah.